I wasn't always selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate. When I was a young fellow, I was a pretty nice guy. But over a period of years, my personality had changed. And that kind of personality is what caused me to do those things to hurt Barbara, which in turn caused her to hurt me. I went to the Internal Revenue Service. If I hadn't have been so dishonest, I wouldn't have been cheating the Internal Revenue Service in the first place. And if I hadn't been cheating them, they wouldn't have caught me and they wouldn't be trying to put me in jail. If Joe hadn't have been so selfish, he wouldn't have been doing the things that he was doing to hurt his wife and children, which caused his mother-in-law to divorce him. If he hadn't have been so dishonest, he wouldn't have been lying to all those people. If he had been more considerate of his wife and children, he wouldn't have been doing those things. So what we're really seeing out in that fifth column is the kind of character that we build through our years of drinking, not even knowing we've done it. So not only can we not differentiate the truth from the false about alcohol, hell, we can't differentiate the truth from the false about us, because we've lived this life of resentments, using resentments to justify everything we've done.
That's right.
And then we could stay selfish and dishonest and self-seeking and frightened and inconsiderate and keep right on doing the things we've always done, blame it on others, and never have to change ourselves. My God, what a lesson in human nature that I got when I worked this inventory the way the book says. Now what I'm really doing, I'm in the process of doing step four at the present time.
Okay.
This is the inventory part of it. But let's see what I've really accumulated here. Out there in that fifth column, I now have the exact nature of the wrong that I'm going to talk to another human being about when I take step five. The wrong is the resentment. That's what's blocking me off from God.
What is the origin?
And the exact nature of it is what is the origin of it, or what's at the core of it. And the core of it is my selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate character. Out there in that fifth column, I see the character defects I'm going to be willing to turn loose of when I get to step six.
Don't like these.
You know, if I stay selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate, I'm going to keep right on doing the same things I've always done. Keep right on hurting people. And they'll retaliate and I'll resent. So I'm going to become willing to turn those loose now that I see them.
That's right.
Out there in that fifth column, I see the shortcomings I'm going to ask God to take away in step seven. And in my case, in your case probably some of them, but in my case, every name on column one turned out to be somebody or an institution that I've hurt. And then they retaliated against me. So they're going to come off of that column one and they're going to be added to a sheet to be used later on for steps eight and nine. When we get to step eight, the book says we got the list, we made it when we took step four. And I didn't even know I'd hurt half of these people. Now in your case, some of your people you resent, you probably didn't hurt them. But in my case, every one of them I did. And I never knew that. And what I've done with this simple little inventory is I've set myself up with all the information I need for step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, resentment wise. Now I hear some of you saying, and I hear awful good, I hear some of you saying, well, Charlie, that's probably true. For those that we did something to them, but how about those that hurt us when we were kids, maybe growing up, and we didn't do anything to them? Aren't we justified in having that kind of resentment? I guess we are if we want to get drunk over it. But you see, a justified resentment blocks you off from the sunlight of the Spirit just as fast as an unjustified resentment does. And that kind of resentment will get you just as drunk, just as fast as any other kind. Now, if we've got one of those, and I don't care what it is now, I don't care whether it's mental abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, or whatever it might be, kids may be growing up, and we didn't do anything to them, Aren't we justified in having that kind of resentment? I guess we are if we want to get drunk over it. But you see, a justified resentment blocks you off from the sunlight of the Spirit just as fast as an unjustified resentment does. And that kind of resentment will get you just as drunk, just as fast as any other kind. Now, if we've got one of those, and I don't care what it is now, I don't care whether it's mental abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, or whatever it might be, if we've got one of those, and we don't want to turn loose of it, then we better get it on this sheet of paper and take a look at it. Because we're probably using it for some reason. Just like the lady in the book. She used her resentment against her mother to rationalize and justify and be able to say, I could have had an education if Mama hadn't have done that to me. Bull. She could have gotten an education if she wanted to. I don't care what Mama did to her. She said, if Mama hadn't have done that to me, my marriage wouldn't have failed. Bull. All you're doing when you do that is you're blaming it on others and not looking at yourself. She even used her resentment against her mother to justify her alcoholism.
She drinking the whiskey.
I'll tell you how she became an alcoholic. She kept on drinking that whiskey. And she drank another, she got in trouble with it. You know, if you've got one of those kind of resentments, let's put their name down here. Let's put the cause of it. Let's put what a part self is affected. Let's put what did I do. In that case, maybe we didn't do anything, so we put nothing. And then in the last column, we look to see, am I using it for a selfish purpose? Am I so dishonest that I'm afraid to look at the truth? Now, I'm going to tell you, if you got one, it's not true. Oh, it started with truth 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. But what's in your mind today is not what really happened then. We distort the picture through these resentments over a period of time. Am I so dishonest that I just won't look at the truth? Am I so frightened, afraid of facing life without that resentment that I just can't turn it loose? Am I so inconsiderate of another human being that I fail to recognize that people that do these things to us, it's not because they're bad people, it's because they're sick people. And they didn't necessarily do it to us, they would have done it to anybody in that position. If I could just even begin to think about that just a little bit, just maybe I could start a forgiving process. Maybe I could straighten up a relationship with another human being before it's too late. If I don't want to do this, knowing it might get me drunk, then I'm probably using it for some reason. You see, you and I cannot afford to play the role of the victim. Because when you play the role of the victim, then the victim is running your life for you. When you're resenting those people for what they did to you 20 years ago, they are controlling how you think today. They're going to control whether you get drunk or not. You have given them the power to kill you. And it doesn't make any sense to let somebody hurt me 20 years ago and then hurt me every day for the rest of my life. I don't have to do that. I've got a sheet that shows me how to get rid of it. And if you inventory them out and it still don't disappear, then you do the final thing, you pray for them. And if you pray for one of those suckers like that, that doesn't mean you're going to like them. That doesn't mean you're going to walk hand in hand with them the rest of your life. That doesn't mean you even forgive. That doesn't mean what they did is right. It simply means you're not going to let them control you any longer. And if you pray for them, it will be removed. And you will be resentment-free. Playing the victim has no place in our program. Because when you play the victim, they've got you. And they'll kill you. Joe?
Okay, you notice how we analyze these resentments. I really love this process. It's so simple. And analyze something, you start from the outside and go in. You know, we begin, the way we analyze, we put this down first. And we went from the outside in. We can see now that the exact nature of it, the origin, our beginning of it, was not out here in the first class. It wasn't these people doing that. The exact nature of the whole problem, the origin of the resentment, began in here in our character defect. We can easily see in my case, because of my selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, inconsiderate character, I did things to my wife and my kids, right? That hurt my mother-in-law. And she retaliated and struck me, right? When we analyzed it, we found out it began from the inside out. But it looks like, so as we get there, we can really see the truth of it. And that's the truth of it that really sets us free from it when we realize what we're doing and how it happened. So if we have analyzed and got rid of these resentments, and these resentments have been replaced, as Charlie said, by love, patience, tolerance, and understanding of other people, we've already entered a process of change, personality change, and we just did one part of the inventory. As he finishes this resentment, he says, we notice that the word fear is bracketed along the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employee, and my wife.
Remember, the second manifestation of self is one that is filled with fear. Can't trust God, can't trust others, can't trust themselves. So they're running filled with fear, and fear controls and dominates the mind. Just like resentment does. Let's spend just a few minutes looking at fear, and then we'll be through for the evening.
And we know when we have fear in our mind is being controlled and dominated by the thing or the person we fear. God is not directing our lives. We are not directing our lives.
Our minds.
So he said this. This short word somehow touches almost every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball a-rolling? Again, just like resentments, we're going to find that all of our fears, we started. We put ourselves in a position to experience that fear. Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It causes more problems. And then he has instructions for us to analyze our fears. And we're going to use the same process. He said, we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. And it was just like resentments, we can't analyze these things in our head. You know, the mind's a great piece of equipment, but it's got one handicap. You can't see but one thing at a time. Right? And you notice when we put these inventory, we put all those things down on those columns one at a time. That's the way we see them. We put them down one at a time, but after we get them all down, we can look at that sheet and analyze them. We cannot analyze them by just seeing one at a time. So this is why we put them down one at a time. And you'd be surprised how many things we're going to have one at a time. We're going to have 100 things on there and we get through. Okay. Now after we put the name, we asked ourselves why we had this. Wasn't because self-reliance failed us. Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us have once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. So number one, we're going to use the same process to analyze our fears.
So in order to avoid any confusion, we just made up another little sheet. almost identical to the resentment sheet, except we call it a review of fears. Column 1, who or what do I fear? We simply take those fears out of our head. We make a list of them in column 1. Now, we men tend to say, well, we don't have much fear. We're macho. We're tough. We're not talking about physical fear. We're talking about all those fears that we have that run through our minds continuously. And everybody's got fear. We have fears connected to what other people think of us. We have fears connected to what's going to happen on our jobs. We have fears connected with our marriages. Are they going to survive or not? We have fears connected with our children. What's going to become of them? We have fears connected with the Internal Revenue Service. We have fears connected with the police department. We have fears connected with the church. My God, we could just name hundreds of fears if we wanted to. We simply take them out of our mind, put them down on a sheet of paper, column 1. I think we'll see the same thing here that we did with resentments. We'll never know how many fears we have until we put them all down on a sheet of paper and see them for the first time. We'll never realize how much fear controls and dominates our thinking till we get them all down on a sheet of paper. And we made a decision in step 3 to let God direct our thinking. And if fear is directed, then God can't. Just like if resentment's directed, God can't. And I don't think we'll ever see that till we put it on paper. Column 2, what's the cause of the fear? Now, this is not an attempt to psychoanalyze. Now, I'm not going to say I'm afraid of the dark because Mother set me on a potty sideways when I was 2 years old. Now, we're supposed to have some fear. Fear brings caution and keeps me from getting hurt sometimes. I am a little bit afraid of the dark. Why? Well, I don't have headlights and I can't see at night. And that kind of fear keeps me from getting hurt. I'm a little bit afraid of heights. Why? I don't have wings and I can't fly. Keeps me from getting hurt. But now, if those fears should keep me from going outside after dark, if they should keep me from riding in an elevator, I better get them on this paper to look at it because they control me and dominate me. Most of my fears are going to be connected with one or two, maybe three things. I'm scared to death I'm going to lose something I already got, such as my marriage, such as my job. I'm scared to death I'm not going to get what I want. That extra job, that extra income, that beautiful girlfriend, that whatever it might be. Or I've done something I shouldn't have done and I'm scared to death what they're going to do when they find out. Nearly every fear revolves around those three things. Column 2, what are they going to do to me? Am I perhaps going to jail? Am I going to lose something with material value? Am I going to lose face? Will it result in divorce? Will it destroy a personal relationship? Might I lose my job, etc.? There's got to be a reason behind it or we won't have it. And we just list it here on the paper. Column 3. What part of self is affected? And once again, you can't experience fear unless there's a threat to one of the basic instincts of life. And for the first time, I see where fear comes from. Just like for the first time I saw where anger comes from, now I see where fear comes from. And it comes from a threat to one of the basic instincts of life. And it's how I choose to react. You know, if my relationship with God's right, my instincts are under control, I don't care what you do to me, you can't create any fear in me. But let my instincts get out of control, and let my relationship with God become less and less, man, just about everything you do to me causes fear, see? I didn't know that till I saw this. Column 4. What did I do? Usually I made a decision based on self, which in many cases puts me in a position to feel this fear. What did I do to set the ball rolling and set in motion trains and circumstances which have led to my being in a position to have the fear in the first place? If I did nothing, I put down nothing. But if I did something like steal, or commit adultery, or lie to my boss, whatever it is, I put it down. Column 5. Which character defect is involved? with the same basic character defects, creating the fears that create the resentments. If I was not so selfish, I wouldn't have to be afraid I'm going to lose what I got or not get what I want. If I was not so dishonest, I wouldn't be putting myself in a position as to have to be worried about what they're going to do if they catch me. If I wasn't such a frightened individual to start with, I wouldn't have to experience so much fear. If I considered other people and their needs and wants ahead of my own, I wouldn't have to experience so much fear. But you can bet your boots, if I stay selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate, I'm going to keep right on doing the same things I've always done. I'm going to keep right on putting myself in positions where I have to experience fear. And sooner or later, that's going to block me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And the next thing you know, I'm going to end up drunk. Now, if you think your resentments look stupid on paper, wait till you get your fears on paper. Golly, they look dumb. They're worse than resentments. They look good in your head, but you get them on paper and they look so stupid. It's absolutely amazing. And about 95% of them are going to disappear, just like with resentments. But there may be one, two, three, or four. So deeply embedded, we may have trouble with that too. We now come to the second prayer in step four in the big book on fear.
We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can lie to those who think spirituality is a way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is a way of strength. The verdict of ages is faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. They never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. And we have a little short prayer. We ask Him to remove our fears and direct our attention to what He would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. You know, if this be the case, you know, we are removing the things that block us, we're carrying out that decision. You know, where there was resentment, there's love, tolerance, patience, goodwill, and understanding on the shelf. Where there's fear, there is now courage. We're changing the stock in trade. The personality change. A lot of positive things are taking place right here in the middle of step four. Also, we have, on by taking the inventory, we have taken step four as far as fear is related. Over in the fifth column, we have the exact nature of the wrong, the exact nature, the inherent characteristic of the fear that we're going to discuss with another person will be listed over in this fifth column. And we're going to talk about that in step five. Seeing how damaging this stuff is and where it's, and what it's causing over in this fifth column, we're now willing to let go of it. And we're going to ask God to remove it in step seven. We also find that some of the people over here that we fear these people because we did something to hurt them.
Scared to death what they're going to do if they find out.
We did something to hurt these people. And the only way to get over that fear is going to be to put those people on the list for step eight and make amends to them. So we're making out the list for step eight while we're doing the inventory. As the book tells us to do that. So, again, if we have done our fears according to the big book, we have gathered all the information while doing step four to do 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 as it relates to our fears.
We hear always about the promises on page 83 and 84. There's promises spread throughout this book. And I think one of the greatest promises is we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be instead, and at once we commence to outgrow that fear. You take these fears just like resentments, you deal with them one at a time, you ask God to take them away, ask Him to show you what He would have you be in place of that, and that fear is going to disappear. Fear and courage could not exist on the same plane. And asking God to remove this fear is one of the greatest acts of courage we can do. And from that comes faith. And faith and fear can't exist on the same plane. Now just think. This little file cabinet I had up here, it's been emptied out now. The damaged and unsaleable goods caused fear is gone. Now we're going to replace the stock in trade. The only thing that can replace it's the opposite. And where my mind used to be filled with fear, now it's filled with faith and courage. Hell, I can do many, many things now that I never could do before. I can quit doing some of those things that I thought I had to do before, because now I'm being controlled by God's will. I didn't have to go to any other fellowships. Didn't have to read any other books. If God dwells within me, faith and courage has always been a part of my makeup. I just never could use it before. But now that the fear is gone, they automatically come to the surface. Never seen anything like this before. The other thing that really amazed me is when I filled out the fear sheet, I saw many of the same names appearing on the fear sheet that I had on the resentment sheet. Barbara was on both sheets. Internal Revenue Service is on both sheets. Many of those names came off of that resentment sheet, also went on this fear sheet. I never had tied that together in my mind before. Never had really realized what was going on in my head. I think it's one of the greatest things we can possibly do for ourselves. Now you'll notice the next thing the book tells us to do is talk about sex. And Joe leaned over here and whispered in my ear a while ago, and he said, "Charlie, I've got a headache." And he said, "I don't feel like sex tonight." Let's get a good night's rest and we'll have sex on Saturday morning. Is that okay with everybody? Tomorrow morning you guys are going to be the most beautiful people in the world. You're going to go tonight wherever you're staying. You're going to work on resentments and fears, and you're going to be absolutely free of those in the morning.
That's right.
God, you're going to look great tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
See you tomorrow. Thanks for being here tonight. Take a drink for 9,516 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. God, you all look good this morning.
That's right. God, resentment free.
Not a resentment left in the whole bunch. Golly.
No, they look good.
How many of you went back to where you were staying last night and worked on at least one resentment? Could we see your hand? Yeah, a whole bunch of you did. How many of you got rid of at least one resentment? Yeah. How many of you did we give a new resentment to yesterday afternoon? Yeah. I'm going to start out the morning by reading a little thing to you that came out of the grapevine. I may not be able to read it. I'm going to try to. It's called Sinking Down the Pour, P-O-U-R. It said, "I had 12 bottles of whiskey in the house, and my wife told me to empty the contents of each bottle in the sink or else. So I proceeded with the unpleasant task. I withdrew the cork from the first bottle and poured the contents down the sink, with the exception of one glass, which I drank. I withdrew the cork from the second bottle and did likewise, with the exception of one glass, which I drank. I withdrew the cork from the third bottle and poured the whiskey down the sink, with the exception of one glass, which I drank. I pulled the cork from the fourth sink and poured the bottle down the glass, which I drank. I pulled the bottle from the cork of the next and drank the sink out of it and threw the rest down the glass. I took the sink out of the glass, bottled the drink, and drank the pour. When I had everything emptied, I steadied the house with one hand, and with the other four hands, I counted the bottles, cork, glasses, and sink. And as the house came by, I counted them again. I finally had all the houses in one bottle, which I drank. I'm not half so thick as you might drunk. But I fooled so foolish that the drunker I stand here, the longer I get. Bonnie found that, and she said, when I read that, I thought, Charlie has got to have that. And she cut it out and gave it to me when I got up here. I love that. Sinking down the pour.
My name is Joe, and I'm a real alcoholic. Through God's grace, because this program works, I haven't found it necessary to drink today, and for this I'm extremely grateful. If we come back to our inventory process, and I think that we have a wonderful opportunity last night and today and this morning, and Jim, our presentations on the inventory, that we all should thoroughly understand this process with what we have been exposed to here as it relates to the inventory. As we said, we're going to look and see where our instincts have gotten out of control and the defects and the things, the way they have warped us. And that all human beings have these basic instincts. And that all human beings have the defects created by these instincts. No one is immune from them. And when you look at our basic instincts of life, we look and see that, and they are God-given, so they're therefore good, standard equipment. And that to make us complete human beings, that these things have to be demanding. And the main thing that makes us so difficult with these instincts is they reward us for satisfying them. That's the trouble. The reward is so great that we tend to overdo them. And all human beings have, these things are so powerful that all of them sometimes is going to make us selfish. They're going to make us self-seeking. They're going to make us frightened. They're going to make us inconsiderate trying to satisfy them and dishonest. Every human being in the world, no one's ever been perfect with it. I'm glad to hear that no one's ever been perfect with this. So we're trying to find out where those defects have warped us. We talked about resentments, and we'll be looking at the total scheme of things, and we looked at fears. And we said also that resentments are a part of life. They are not bad. God didn't give us anything bad. It's just how we use it. And what we're going to be doing here is not so much getting rid of resentments or getting rid of fears, but putting them back in the place they should be. The whole scheme of success is rearrangements and adjustments, putting them back in place. And then we're going to have a continuous program to monitor them on a daily basis. You know, resentments are healthy in a certain place, not the way we've been using them. But when someone does something that threatens my self-esteem, it makes me look small, and he goes out and does something, if it causes me to look at myself, it causes me to go inside and use my abilities to accomplish something, then this is constructive. See, when one person goes, it makes us competitive, it makes us want to use our ability. And we use the illustration all the time of how to use resentments. You know, say a person, we're living here in a neighborhood and we become complacent. We come home and our house don't look too good. It needs a paint job. Some of the windows broke out. We just come home every day and sit on the porch and rock and enjoy ourselves. And all the rest of the neighborhood looks about the same way. So we were satisfied. And finally, one day, some idiot moves in across the street and buys a house. And we look out there, and he is painting his house. He is putting in window paint. And that makes us look at our house, reacting.
We resent the hell out of him for doing that.
We resent the hell out. Who is he messing up the neighborhood? But then it makes us look at our house, reacting to him. And we decide, we need to fix up a little bit. So we fix up our house and put in some new window panes because he did. And then our next neighbor resents me, and he fixes up his house, and down the street the next one begins to do something. Pretty soon God's got the whole neighborhood looking pretty good. Well, that's the reason God gave it to us. He gave it to use our ability to get ahead, to leap, and to improve and have a changing society using our intelligence to do that. Now, the alcoholic doesn't use it that way. We use it another way. See, an alcoholic would stand there in the same case, and the guy fixed up his house. The alcoholic would come home every evening, sit on the porch, and rock, and resent the hell out of that guy. You know, never do nothing, just sit there and get mad, right? And one night he'd go over and burn his damn house down. That's the way we use it. So we're not going to get rid of resentments. We will be using it in a constructive way in our lives. So same way with fears. Fears are healthy in the right place. We couldn't live without that. And now we're going to go into the last area. It talks about our sexual harms to others, and these brings on guilt and remorse. And actually, it's the guilt and remorse that blocks us from people. You know, resentments allow other people to dominate us. Fears allow other people to dominate us and block us from God. And our guilt and remorse that comes from our harms to others, guilt and remorse effectively blocks us in the same way. It blocks us from God. And also we want to mention constantly that whatever blocks us from God at the same time blocks us from other people.
We talked about this little store I had up here in my head yesterday, and we had some display cases filled with resentments, and we worked on those resentments and we got rid of them to the level God intends for it to be. And they were replaced with love, patience, tolerance, compassion, goodwill toward our fellow man. And automatically we began to feel better in that part of our store. Then we looked at the fears that was in the little file cabinet over here. We did something about the removal of the fears, and they had to be replaced with the opposite, which was faith and courage. So in 2/3 of our store, we're in pretty good shape. But we also had this storage room back here in the back of the store that was filled with guilt and remorse. And we really haven't done anything about that at all yet. So what we're going to start doing now is look at the harms and the hurts that we do to other people and try to see the truth about those also. And we find in most cases that we can't even any more see the truth about them than we could about resentments or we could about fears. So we're going to have to get this down on paper and look at it too. Now, it seems as though we human beings hurt each other faster and easier in the sexual area than we do in any other way. And I think probably the reason for that is when it comes to sex and with we human beings, we're a little bit different than the other animals here on Earth. You know, the other animals here on Earth, they also have the sex drive, the sex urge. They have to have that in order to reproduce themselves, just like we have to have it. But the difference in their sex lives and ours is, normally they don't have any choice. You see, they don't have this self-will that we have. They don't have the ability to make choice. Everything they do is on God's direction. And when it comes time for them to have sex, God usually signifies that by some physical change in the female of the species. The male will sense that change, prepares himself, the two join together, and it's kind of like bang, bang, thank you, ma'am. And when it's over with, they normally go their separate ways. Now, they didn't think about having sex before they had it, and they didn't think about having sex while they were having it, and they didn't think about having sex after they got through with it. They don't have those abilities. Usually, they can't choose the one they're going to have sex with. Now, once in a while they do, but most of them can't. They can't choose when they're going to have sex. They can't choose how many partners they're going to have sex with in most cases. They can't choose how many times they're going to have it. And they can't even choose what position they're going to do it in. Everything that they do is done at God's direction. Therefore, you see very few emotional problems, sexual-wise, among the other animals here on earth. I've never seen a cow on a psychiatrist's couch yet talking about sexual dysfunction. They just don't have those kind of problems. We human beings are a little bit different. God not only gives us the sex urge so that we will reproduce ourselves, but He also gives us this thing called self-will and allows us to make choices and decisions regarding our sex lives. You know, we can have sex anytime we want to. We can have sex any day of the year that we wish to do so. We can choose who we're going to have sex with. We can decide whether we're going to have sex with one or more partners. We can decide how many times we're going to have sex, providing we're physically capable of doing so. We can even decide what position we're going to have sex in. You know, they're telling me there's something like 64 different positions a human being can have sex in. I have no idea what they are. I only found 3 in my lifetime. And 2 of those damn near kill me. I'm not sure I'm going back to them. So what we're going to look at for just a few minutes this morning is not so much as to how we do sex, as to how we think about sex. Because how we think about sex determines what we're going to do. And what we do then determines whether it's going to hurt other people or not. And that in turn determines whether we're going to be eaten up with guilt and remorse, fear that they're going to catch us, and then if they do catch us and retaliate, eaten up with resentments and etc. So all we're going to do is see a little way to look at our past sex life, kind of review what it's been, see if maybe in the process we've been creating problems for others, see if maybe we can shape a new sex life for the future, where not only can we live with it and enjoy it, but at the same time not hurt other people. And if we can do that, then we could have sex and have fun with it, and not end up hurting people and have to pay the price then in resentment and fear and guilt and remorse. And it's going to be a very simple process, just like the resentments and just like the fear. He said, now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. Now, we're at the bottom of page 68. You older fellows, don't get your hopes up. We're not going to overhaul the physical side, just the mental side. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cried that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. And you and I have heard them all of our lives. They're the ones that say sex is a dirty thing, that you ought to do it at one time, in one position, with one person only. And the only reason to do it is to reproduce yourself. And if you enjoy it, it's a sinful thing. I've heard them as far back as I can remember. They are to the extremes on one side. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. And you hear them today. They're the ones that says you ought to be able to do sex anytime you want to, anywhere you want to, with anybody you want to, as many times as you want to, and you ought to be able to enjoy it every time, and if you don't, there must be something wrong with you. You know, maybe today they would call that the sexual revolution. Main thing I see wrong with it happened 25 years too late for Joe and I to participate in it. I know that.
Missed the whole
thing. We just missed the whole damn thing. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. But we want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? And I read that last statement with great relief. because I knew this book was getting ready to condemn me for what I had been in the past. I knew it was getting ready to tell me what I was going to have to do in the future, and I'd already made up my mind that I wasn't going to pay any attention to it at all. And I was glad to find out that they're not going to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We simply are not going to get into that question. Now, this book is meant to be helpful to anybody, anywhere, anytime. And if we start trying to tell people what they can and cannot do in the sexual area, start trying to tell them what kind of sex life they're going to have, then surely we're going to begin to alienate people. Besides that, what's sexually acceptable in one part of the world may not be acceptable at all in another part of the world. So that's a question we're not going to get into. What we are going to do is see a way to review our own past sex life, see what we've been doing with it, see if maybe we've harmed people with it, and see if we can't shape a new sex life for the future. Now, I think when most of us get here, we're just about as confused about this sexual thing as we were about spirituality. You know, as I said yesterday, when I was 12 or 13 years old, I left that church, and I made up my mind then that I wasn't going to have anything to do with the preacher or God, and I wasn't going to pay any attention to what my parents or my teacher said. And when I got to AA, I was 38 years old, and I got here with the spiritual knowledge of about a 12-year-old boy. Well, as I go back and review my sex life, I find that just about the same thing happened in that area. You know, when we were kids growing up and getting into the high school age and the age when boys really begin to think about sex, we didn't have this formal sex education in school that they have today. Oh yeah, we had sex education all right, but we called it recess. And it was usually out behind a tree somewhere with no formality to it at all. And I'll never forget, as a boy growing up, I began to be real concerned about this sex thing at age 12 or 13 years old. And I'm like my friend, the other friend called Joe from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma too. And I know, as I began to start trying to find out about sex, I couldn't talk to my parents. In those days, you just couldn't hardly talk to them about sex or anything else. You couldn't talk to your teachers about sex. You didn't have any good sex education books in school. So that only really leaves you one place or one source of information to find out about sex. And in West Tulsa, Oklahoma, there was a cafe called the Jenkins Cafe. And every evening about 6:30, 7:30, there would be a bunch of wise, learned individuals standing out in front of that cafe, and they were 15, 16, 17 years old, and they knew everything in the world there was to know about sex. So you go to these guys that are older than you are, and you talk to them about sex, and they're more than willing to tell you about it. In fact, these guys would tell me how many girls they were having sex with every night. They would tell me how many different times they were having sex with those girls every night. And you know, I was in AA sober 3 or 4 years before I figured out those guys were lying to me. At least I hope they were lying to me. I never will forget the first time I had sex. I was scared to death. I was very worried. I was apprehensive. I knew I would get caught just sure as anything. And I was also alone. That's probably why I'm wearing glasses today, too. Every time I say that, I see 3 or 4 guys jerk their glasses off and put them in their pocket. I wonder how many of us learned about sex the same way that I did. Could I see your hand? Yeah. Hell, no wonder we're screwed up when we get to AA. Now, Bill gives us the same set of instructions here to look at our past sex life as he did for resentments, except once again worded just a little bit differently. So what we've done is we made up another little sheet. We called it a review of our own conduct or our own sex conduct. Here he says, we reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. So we made up this other little sheet, and in column one, who did I hurt? Now, I doubt if there's anybody in this room this morning that ever hurt anybody in a sexual area that we don't know exactly who that is. You know, that seems to be a form of knowledge that all of us seem to have inside ourselves somewhere. We simply have to take those names out of our head and put them down on a sheet of paper. There might be a little question come up as to what do we do to hurt people in a sexual area. And, you know, I think we can hurt them in many different ways. For instance, if I'm in a married relationship, which I am today, and I go outside of my marriage and I have sex out there, and my wife finds out about that, then surely I've created a problem for her. If not physically, at least emotionally. If there's children in my home, and that sexual affair I had out there creates a problem between my wife and I, then surely I've beginning to hurt my children also by that same sex act. If the lady I had sex with out there, if it becomes common knowledge, I've hurt her too. If she has children and a husband, then I've hurt them also. One sex act could hurt many different people. Sometimes I think we hurt people in a sexual area simply by demanding more than our fair share. You know, maybe our partner's not too keen to have sex every time we want them to. And sometimes, rather than consider their needs, wants, and desires, we selfishly demand that they have sex with us when they really don't want to. Surely we create a problem for them, if not physically, at least emotionally. I think sometimes we hurt people in a sexual area by demanding that they do things with us that they really would rather not do. And once again, rather than consider their needs, wants, and desires, we selfishly demand that they do those things. Surely we create a problem for them, if not physically, at least emotionally. I think maybe sometimes we hurt people in a sexual area simply by withholding sex. Maybe we're not too keen to have sex every time our partner wants to. And sometimes, rather than consider their needs, wants, and desires, we selfishly withhold sex when perhaps we should give in a little more often. Many, many ways we hurt people. I think we all pretty well know what they are, and I think we pretty well know who we hurt. Column one, we make a list of who did I hurt. And again, I don't think we can ever see the full extent of this until we get it all down on paper. You can only see one thing at a time in your mind. And I don't think any of us can ever realize the full extent of the past sex life and the people we've harmed until we get them all down on a sheet of paper. Column two, what did I do to hurt them? Did I commit adultery? Did I demand they do things that they didn't want to do? So on and so forth. Column three, which part of self is affected here? Now, I think this might be one of the most revealing things we can do for ourselves. Now, you would think if I hurt somebody in a sexual area that it would be caused by the sex instinct. And I guess maybe once in a while that's true. Sometimes in order to get the physical gratification, the emotional gratification that comes at the moment of successful completion of the sex act, maybe we were doing the wrong thing at the wrong time with the wrong person because of the sex instinct. But I think if we carefully look at each occasion we're going to find that the other two instincts are involved just as much as sex, and in many cases more so, and in some cases sex really doesn't have anything to do with it. Now I'm going to express an opinion, and I want to make it clear now that this is my opinion, not Joe's opinion, not AA's opinion, or anybody else's, just mine. I'm convinced that God gave us the sex urge so that we could and would reproduce ourselves. I'm also convinced He made it a very pleasurable thing so that we would do so. I don't think you and I would do the kind of work involved in sex if we didn't get a reward for doing so. And it is one of the most pleasurable things that a human being can do. Now, if we're doing sex for purposes other than that, for purposes other than reproduction or enjoyment, we just might be doing sex for purposes other than what God intended. For instance, we boys found out at a very early age that you can use sex to build your self-esteem. After all, the more members of the opposite sex you can attract to yourself, the greater a man you really are, we thought. And we boys called that John Wayneism. Now, I don't know what you girls called it, but some of you tell me that you use sex for the same purposes. Now, if that's what we're using sex for, to build our self-esteem, then that's not to really reproduce nor enjoy, but that's to fulfill a part of the social instinct, and sex really doesn't have a hell of a lot to do with that. You know, sometimes we use sex to buy a personal relationship. Maybe we're just lonesome. Maybe we just want somebody to pay attention to us. And we found out a long time ago that we can give sex and buy back a personal relationship. Now that certainly is not to reproduce nor to enjoy, but that's to fulfill also a part of the social instinct and also to build our emotional security. Sex really doesn't have a hell of a lot to do with that. Sometimes we use sex to buy material security. Maybe we're in a sexual situation we really would rather not even be in. And we found out a long time ago that we become so overly dependent upon another human being for our material well-being that we give sex to buy back the material well-being. Now that's certainly not to reproduce. That's not to enjoy. But that's to fulfill the security instinct. Sex really doesn't have much to do with that. You know, sometimes we use sex to get even with another human being. Maybe we're in a relationship, we find out our partner's gone out and they've done something they shouldn't do, and we say we'll show them. And we'll go out and do exactly the same thing. And the fallacy in that is after we've done it, we can't afford to tell them we did it. But certainly we didn't use sex there to reproduce nor to enjoy. We used it to get even with another human being. Sex really doesn't have much to do with that. You know, sometimes we use sex to force our will on another human being. Maybe our partner isn't doing what we think they ought to do. And we say we'll show them. We'll just cut them off at the pass. And we won't let them have it until they come around our way of thinking. Now, we boys aren't too good at that. We only last about 3 days. But you girls have honed that to perfection. You know exactly how to do that, and I don't blame you. I'd do it too if it worked that good for me. But that has nothing to do with reproduction or enjoyment. That's to force our will on another human being. I think this was one of the most amazing things that I ever saw. When I filled out that column 3 and began to see what I had really been doing with sex, 2 things happened to me almost automatically. As I filled out that 3rd column, a lot of guilt began to disappear. You know, I thought I was just a dirty, rotten, no good SOB. But I found out that isn't true. That I use sex for purposes other than what God intended. Not because I'm a bad person, but because I'm sick in those other areas. And I use sex to build my self-esteem. I use sex to buy personal relationships, not because I'm bad, but because I'm sick in those areas. And when I saw that, a lot of that guilt began to disappear. I began to feel better about me right there. The second thing that happened to me as I filled out the third column is I began to realize what I had been using sex for was kind of dumb. I always thought I was oversexed. No, I wasn't oversexed. I was undersecure. And I used sex to build my security and to build my self-esteem. And when I saw that's what I was doing with it, it began to look kind of dumb to do that. And the instant it began to look kind of dumb, that desire to go do it at the wrong time in the wrong place with the wrong people gradually began to become less and less and less. And I started getting a handle on this sex thing right here in the third column. Very revealing piece of information. Column 4. What feelings did I create in others? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? What should I have done instead? Now, we're trying to shape a new sex life for the future. Not only do we have to look and see what we've done in the past to hurt people, but we need to be looking at what should I have done instead. And whatever I should have done instead, that's going to start being the new sex life of the future. Column 5. Same basic character defects. Now, the harm I've done to hurt another human being is the wrong. But the exact nature of that are those key defects within me that made up my old personality that caused me to do those things that hurt other people. If I wasn't so selfish, I wouldn't have to go out and do sex at the wrong time in the wrong place. If I wasn't so dishonest, I wouldn't have to be sneaking around behind my wife's back and doing those things in the first place. If I wasn't such a frightened individual, I wouldn't be trying to use sex to build my security. If I really, really, really considered my wife and children ahead of myself, I wouldn't be doing those things in the first place. I wouldn't be taking a chance on hurting them. But I'll guarantee you one thing. If I stay selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate, I'm going to keep right on hurting people. And I'm going to be scared to death what they're going to do when they find out. And even if they don't catch me, the guilt and remorse is going to eat me up. It's going to block me off from God, and eventually it's going to kill me. It's not a question of what's right and wrong. It's a question of what can I do and live with it. And if I don't shape some kind of new sex life for the future, where not only can I enjoy sex and be satisfied with it, yet at the same time not hurt other people, then chances are this is going to create lots of problems for me. The sex drive is a tremendous urge. You know, unless we get a handle on some of these things, we're in serious trouble. Joe?
Okay. Whatever I determine to be, we must be willing to grow toward it.
Let's back up one paragraph.
Okay. In this way, we try to shape a sane and sound idea of our future sex life by looking at the past. We get that information to develop the future. We subjected each relationship to the test, was it selfish or not? And I think that's very easily. Each sexual relation, we can, is it selfish or not? And we can all answer that. We ask God to mold ideas, and we see prayer throughout here. It's throughout this second, on both pages. We ask God to mold ideas and help us live up to them. We remember always that our sex powers are God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly, selfishly, nor to be despised or loathed. Whatever ideas turn out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. And we see a reference there to step 9. In other words, we treat sex as would any other problem. Again, more prayer and meditation. We ask God what we should do in each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. You know, this is one area in human life I think that we always have had. This is nothing new. I've never been in a sexual situation that was wrong that I didn't seem to know it. It seems to be that we know that. God alone can judge our sex situation. That's great. You know, other people can't judge it. We already have that judgment here. Accounts with other persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. That means use that inner guidance that we have in each questionable situation. That's nothing new. We all have that. We realize that some people are fanatical about sex and others are loose. We avoid hysteria, thanking our advice. And here, you know, we use that quiet directions we have within us here. We don't have to have advice from other people. In fact, we don't know which ones we're talking to when we ask for advice. You know, I always laugh, and that's one thing peculiar about the fellowship. You can get a lot of sexual advice around Alcoholics Anonymous. What a hell of a place to get sexual advice.
I can't think of a worse place in the world to get it than at AA.
Yeah, you can get a lot of sexual and a lot of financial advice around the fellowship. God.
I had a young fellow come to me not long ago, and he said, "Charlie, my sponsor told me I couldn't have any sex for the first year. Is that right?" And I said, "Well, no, that's not right." I said, "You can have all the sex you want the first year. The second year, you can have it with other people." Well, hell, quitting drinking is hard enough. You know,
suppose we follow Charlie, the chosen idea, and stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but this is only half true. It depends upon our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have an honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we have given and learned our lesson. We are not sorry, and our conduct continues to harm others. We are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts of our experiences.
You see, they had the same problems, mm-hmm. the same difficulties yeah. back in the 1930s that we've got today. Human nature never changes. Mm-mm. Nothing is really new. We just repeat the same old mistakes over and over and over again. We know for sure if we can continue to harm other people, then sooner or later, that's going to give us a problem. They're going to retaliate. We're going to feel resentment toward them. If they don't catch us, we're going to be afraid of what they're going to do if they do catch us. And in addition to that, the guilt and remorse just simply eats us up. And sooner or later, we pay the price. It's not a question of what's right and wrong. It's a question of, can I still do that kind of stuff and then live with it and at the same time have peace of mind and serenity? And I think most of us will find out we can't. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. Remember always, when we help other people, that gets us out of self. Yeah. And we quit thinking about what we need and what we want, and we start concentrating on other people, and it helps us out.
That's right.
We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the horny condition. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. Old Bill had some fancy words, didn't he? Now, what we've really done, if we have done the sex inventory the way the book says, we're still in the process of doing step four. And up here on the screen, Joey's making a few little marks like we did yesterday. Out in that fifth column, I see the exact nature of the wrong. Now, the wrong is the harm I've done to another. But what's the inherent characteristic? What's at the center of it? I see those things within me, that old personality that creates this.
Defects.
Out in that fifth column, I see the defects of character I'm willing to turn loose of when I get to step six. Out in that fifth column, I see those shortcomings I'm going to ask God to take away in step seven. And quite naturally, all the names in column one on this list will come off of this list to be added on for step eight and nine at a later date, because I've harmed all these people. And again, the thing that really amazed me is in many cases I kept seeing the same names appearing on all three sheets. Barbara was on all three sheets. Internal Revenue Service was on all three sheets too. I resented them and I feared them and I gave them a pretty good screwing before I got through. I better quit saying that. They're going to be after me someday. Now we're gonna suggest we do one more thing before we leave the inventory. When we get to steps 8 and 9, it says we have the list. We made it when we took step 4. But well, we took some people that we've harmed off the resentment sheet. We took some we've harmed off the fear sheet. We take all of those we've harmed off the sex sheet. Now then, we're going to suggest we make up one more little form, and we call it a review of harms other than sexual. And now let's start making a list of people we've hurt that so far hasn't shown up on any of our list. Some of those maybe we stole from.
Talk them out.
Some of those maybe we undercut them and took their jobs away from them. Some of those that we've hurt physically, many, many ways we've hurt other human beings. And now let's make a list of all those we've hurt in any other way. Now, if they've shown up on the resentment sheet and we could see we owe them amends, we don't need to put them here. If they've shown up on the fear sheet and we see that we owe them amends, we don't need to put them here. If they've shown up on the sex sheet, they don't put any other names. Let's start making the list. Column 1, who did it hurt? Column 2, what did I do? Column 3, what part of self is affected? You know, I can't hurt another human being unless one of these basic instincts is out of control. Column 4, what feelings did I create in others? And what should I have done instead? Once again, we're trying to change directions. Now we're going to quit trying to do, or we're going to quit trying to do those things we used to do, or try quitting those things we used to do. But we also need to be looking at what should we have done instead of that, because that's what we're going to aim for in the future. Column 5. Once again, where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, or inconsiderate? I just can't do anything to hurt another human being unless one of those character defects is in force at that particular time. And you let me become selfish, I'm going to hurt somebody. If I'm dishonest, I'm going to hurt somebody else. If I'm frightened and afraid, eventually I hurt other people. If I'm inconsiderate, I'm going to hurt other people sooner or later. So once again, we're in the process of taking step 4. This is the last part of it. And out in the 5th column, we see the exact nature of the wrong we'll talk to another human being about in 5, the defects for 6, the shortcomings for 7, and quite naturally all the names in column 1 will be used for 8 and 9. Now if we'll do this, we have now fully completed our inventory. We've looked at those things that block us off from God. We've gotten rid of the resentments to the level God wants us to. We've gotten rid of fear to the level God wants us to. Some of the guilt and remorse is already beginning to disappear. We'll get rid of the rest of it later on, but some of it's already starting to disappear. Let's see what the results now will be.
Okay. If we have been through our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. He doesn't say it, but we have listed and analyzed our fears. We have also listed and analyzed our sex conduct of the past. We have even listed and analyzed the people we have harmed.
In any other way.
Yeah.
And to analyze, remember, is just
to get
down
to the
truth. When a detective comes to the crime scene,
that's right.
The first thing the detective does is analyze the crime scene.
The evidence. Yeah.
He's trying to find out the truth.
That's right.
So this is simply, Bill, using another word that means truth.
That's right.
We've taken a moral, truthful, honest, analytical inventory. We've tried to see the truth about these things.
We have begun to comprehend, if we have done this, their futility and fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destruction. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men. Even our enemies, we look at them as sick people. And very subtly here we find the first personality change as a result of these steps. See, we didn't get any personality change from step one. That just shows us a problem, no progress. Two, this shows us, step two shows us a possible solution. Step three is just a beginning, no progress, just deciding to do something. Step four is a first step of action, and it brings about all the action steps are going to produce personality changes. So we have our first personality change after step four. You know, every time an alcoholic begins to learn patience, tolerance, and goodwill toward all men, even his enemies, that's a lot of progress for a brand new sick alcoholic.
Oh, that's a big change already.
We have listened to people we have hurt, but our conduct and our willing to straighten out the past if we can. You know, we have made out the list for step eight, and you know, I think the reason why we are asked to do this in step four. See, we could have a list of names of people we hurt, but that's all we would have to name. But if we put this down and analyze it, we not only got the name, we got how we involved, what happened, and what caused us to do this. We got more than the name. We got the whole picture of how the thing come about. We see how we were involved in it, and it makes us easier and more willing to make the amend. This is why we are asked to make out the list while we're doing step four. It makes it easier for you. Okay. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we cannot do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. Remember, we're talking about looking for the things that blocked us. If you have already made a decision,
step three,
and an inventory of your grosser handicaps.
Step four.
You have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. And here he says step three, and then he talks about four as our grosser handicaps. Now we got another step that we got another inventory that we're going to practice for the rest of our lives, but we begin with our grosser handicaps. We start off, work on our grosser handicaps, and get on with our program. And we see the great mistake around the fellowship is most people coming into the program and they try to wait till they get well to take the steps. You know, when I get well enough, I'm going to do my inventory. Well, you take the inventory to get well. You know, start right as soon as we can. Get the grosser things out of the way and get on with working on our lives. This is the excitement. And, you know, we haven't listed any dirty, filthy things. It really wasn't what we thought it was. The inventory is a very positive process. It's a very positive happening. It's our first personality change as a result of these steps.
What are the grosser handicaps?
Yeah.
Those things that block us from God. Resentment, fear, guilt, and remorse. What are the grosser handicaps? Those things within ourselves that cause the resentment, the fear, and the guilt and remorse. Our selfishness, our dishonesty, our self-seeking, frightened character, our inconsideration of other people. We've looked at the things that create our problems for us. Our liquor is but a symptom.